This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, it was revealed that the popular historians Stephen Ambrose and Doris Kearns Goodwin had both used numerous passages from other historians' works without putting them in quotations. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been looking at the latest spate of plagiarism scandals and has just one question. Why do writers bother to do it?
The striking thing about plagiarism is how rarely anybody has anything original to say about it. Including that, let me hasten to add. At least, that's pretty much the point that Thomas Mallon makes in his classic history of plagiarism called Stolen Words, New York, Tickner and Fields, 1989. There's a remarkable sameness about these literary scandals going back to the 18th century, the indignant accusations, the protestations of innocent error, and above all, the puzzling gratuitousness of the crime. I'm not talking now about a student who goes on the internet to buy a term paper for a course he hasn't attended all semester. That may be reprehensible, but it isn't mysterious. But why do competent and successful writers stoop to copying unattributed passages from other published works, often works that are well known enough so that detection is pretty likely? And why are the passages they steal so often banal and unnecessary? The answer's different for different writers. Why did Samuel Taylor Coleridge appropriate numerous passages of German philosophy in his Biographia Literaria, most of them digressions that add very little to the work? Biographers have suggested that Coleridge did it because he was blocked or depressed or had a self-destructive impulse. But you could hardly claim that Stephen Ambrose suffers from writer's block, and there's no evidence that he's self-destructive. In part, his plagiarism seems to be simply a sign of arrogance, a sense that his vast popular audience would neither know nor care if he steals the words of some obscure academic historian. But in Ambrose's case, the deficiency is as much aesthetic as moral. Take this sentence from Ambrose's recent bestseller, The Wild Blue, one of many that came almost verbatim from a book by the historian Thomas Childers. Up, up, up he went until he got above the clouds. B-24s, glittering like mica, were popping up out of the clouds. You wonder why an author would want to pass that bit off as his own. Not just purple writing, but somebody else's shade of purple. It's the sign of a writer who's deaf to his own voice, and in fact, of a writer who doesn't really care whether he has a voice at all. In Doris Kearns Goodwin's case, though, the plagiarisms are more puzzling, not just because she's a better writer than Ambrose, but because the passages she stole are so pedestrian that it's a mystery that anybody would bother to lift them. Here's one of a number of sentences from Goodwin's 1987 book, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, that were lifted more or less verbatim from Lynn McTaggart's 1983 biography of Kathleen Kennedy. Hardly a day passed without a newspaper photograph of little Teddy taking a snapshot with his camera held upside down, or the five Kennedy children lined up on a train or bus. Why would anybody bother to steal that sentence? Goodwin's explanation was that the borrowing wasn't intentional. She said she had taken notes in longhand when she was preparing the book, then lost track of which bits she had written herself. That appeal to muddled note-taking is a familiar motif in these affairs. It's the same explanation that Alex Haley gave when it turned out that his book Roots included numerous passages from Harold Courlander's novel The African. And in fact, it's the defense that Coleridge's nephew Henry offered for his uncle's literary derelictions. He explained that Coleridge was a very sloppy note-taker who mixed his own thoughts with the thoughts of others, which he later failed to recognize as such. But this sort of explanation is hard to credit, particularly in Goodwin's case. Suppose you were taking notes in longhand from a biography, and you ran across a sentence like, "Hardly a day passed without a photograph of little Teddy taking a snapshot with his brownie held upside down." You wouldn't write that down word for word. You'd put down something like, page 25, frequent pics of Ted with upside down brownie. And it strains credulity to imagine that Goodwin could have written down 40 or 50 such sentences verbatim and then forgotten that they weren't her own. But then why did Goodwin do it? Actually, my own suspicion is that it may very well have been inadvertent, at least on her part. It's easier to believe that one of her research assistants copied some of the sentences from the McTaggart book in the course of summarizing it, and that Goodwin just dumped the assistant's summaries into her book without checking them against the source. Whatever the truth is, though, we can't let Goodwin off the hook. It may be that authors like Goodwin and Ambrose have become less like writers and more like managers, coordinating the activity of their staffs. But as other recent events have reminded us, CEOs are still responsible for everything that goes on their watch. Not long ago, the American Historical Association dropped the clause in its statement on plagiarism that said that there had to be an intent to deceive. As an official of the association explained, it's plagiarism whether you intend to do so or not. And we haven't yet gotten to the point where we'll allow our authors to claim credit for the words of paid researchers or ghostwriters or speechwriters the way we allow Jack Welch or George W. Bush to do. In the end, that's all an author is, after all, somebody whose words we pay to read.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford and the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. This is Fresh Air.